Well, I've been asked to give a conference summary of this conference, and my assignment apparently is to summarize 34 talks and something and 17 posters in 60 minutes. And indeed, this is a somewhat daunting task. I didn't realize how daunting it would be when I first accepted this invitation, but as the time to prepare this talk got closer and closer, I got more and more worried about it and realized how difficult it was, and I really didn't know what to do. And I guess I started to panic, and then I remembered what I had learned earlier in the conference, and that was that if you're really in trouble and you have a real hard task, what you should do is call General Colin Powell and ask for advice. So I did that yesterday afternoon, and I have to say that my results were not as successful as Dr. Shankar's. First thing that happened was I was put on hold for 45 minutes. And then eventually I got a secretary, and the secretary there was no way the secretary was going to put me through to speak to the general. You know, who was I? And I explained I was from Harvard. It was a him. It was a him. I told him that I was getting desperate. I really needed. I said, but I said I'm a good friend of Professor Shankar of Yale University. He said, oh, well, okay. So they put me through, and I got to the general. The general was glad to speak to me. I told him my problem. I said, look, you know, I have to explain. We have this wonderful conference here with these great talks, and I have to prepare a summary, which will be, first of all, it has to be useful for all the assembled, I don't know, 100 people or something who have attended the conference, all experts in the field, and it also has to be intelligible to the 200,000 people out there on the internet who don't know anything about this, who are going to be tuning in from the beaches or whatever, and what do I do? And I explained about everything that went on in the conference. I talked about battle inside transition and so forth. He said, you know something, buddy, you're on your own on this one. So that was the end of that one. And so I had to figure out something. And well, okay, so I thought, first of all, let's start slowly. The easy thing to do, I think non-controversially, we can all begin by thanking the conference coordinators, Shankar Dasarma, Matthew Fisher, Steve Gerben, and Alan McDonald, who really have put together a terrific conference, as well as a very nice program for the next few months. And of course, all the speakers who've given me so much to talk about. I should thank also David Gross for enabling us to do this, and the ITP staff, who I think really have been superb. At least I found that they've taken care of everything, and all my, I wanted something done, or it was just done very well. And the caterers, whom I think have really been exceptional. Of course, the ITP staff lined them up, and they get credit for that, too. So that's all been great. So I think we can all agree on that. Now, the second thing is maybe a little bit more controversial. I think we should change the conference title a little bit to add disorder interactions in quantum Hall and mesoscopic systems and related subjects. And I think we have to do that because, after all, one of the most interesting topics in the conference is the metal insulator transition in zero field in the first session. And I think we'd all agree that that's very exciting. And most people, at least what I polled, would say that a transition in a pure in a two-dimensional system, if we're talking about a two-dimensional system, a large two-dimensional system, it's not mesoscopic. That's the definition. Okay, so we have to add related subjects. Now, you may say that I'm being a little nitpicking here, but apparently at ITP it's very important that a conference you know, if you have a subject for the conference, you conform to that subject. At least I found last week I was, David Gross, director, asked me to explain, to give him a little preview of the conference and say, you know, what's going to be really interesting. And I started mentioning this, and he said, but is this quantum Hall effect? No. Is it mesoscopic systems? Well, not really. And he got really upset about this. And so I guess, now of course David's not here. He's off and flying to France or something, but I'm sure he's watching on the internet. So I would like to, or listening on the internet. So I would like to at least propose this change. Do we need a vote of the conference? I don't know how this takes, but maybe only David can approve it, I suppose, anyway. But I think that would be more accurate. And maybe it would make him happy. I think there's another reason for this. In David's first talk, David's welcoming speech, he mentioned that, you know, people in Washington think that there are too many people working on quantum Hall effect, and it's a mature field, which is really a very dirty word. And there may be people in Washington listening on the internet to this conference, to my talk, and of course, I think if they've been listening to the conference, they know that the quantum Hall effect is really alive and well. There's a lot of exciting things that we've been talking about here. But just to make sure that they're not, in case they missed that point, I want to emphasize the conference is not only, it's not just about quantum Hall effect, and it's not even just about mesoscopic systems, which maybe there were also too many people working on. Maybe that's also getting mature. But it's about related subjects, which is actually pretty broad. And these subjects are these subjects are related because, we know that, you know, experiment people use similar samples, everything we're talking about involves typically delicate measurements, typically electronic transport measurements and other measurements at low temperatures. The samples are often similar, and often they do involve very tiny samples, and even if the samples are big, you still have to attach small leads to them. And they involve lithographic techniques. And the theoretical tools, of course, are also very similar because we use quantum many-body theory and we'd study disorder and interactions, regardless of whether we're looking at mesoscopic systems. It's only so many ideas, only so many people. If that's acceptable, I would like to go on and talk about some of the individual subjects. And I would like to also, as a next step, reorder the conference a little bit. I mean, we don't have to go through the whole thing all over again, but in my discussion, I'd like to group things a little bit differently than the way they were actually grouped chronologically, and I would like to begin by talking about three areas of that have to do with zero magnetic field. Again, in case the people in Washington are listening, and they may get tired after the first few minutes, the first half of my talk, they won't think it's all quantum Hall effect. So there really was three. First of all, of course, the metal insulator transition in two dimensions, which began with Kravchenko's talk, experiment, and then the theory talks of Chakravarti, Varma, and Xie. And I put Zhang's talk in this category too, although a lot of his experiments that he talked about were in large magnetic fields. The idea was to extrapolate to zero magnetic fields, and some of the measurements were actually done in zero fields. And there were various poster sessions that I can mention also that had to do with this subject, including a very interesting work of observing Wigner crystallization apparently in zero field in two-dimensional systems in the poster by Yon et al. Now, then, of course, we also had a lot of very interesting work on one-dimensional wires, which included particular beautiful experiments of Decker on nanotubes, carbon nanotubes, and Balanz's Leon Balanz's theory of carbon nanotubes, and then also the work on cleaved-edge overgrowth systems that Pfeiffer talked about. And then finally, the real mesoscopic zero-dimensional systems, so-called ultra-small grains of superconductors, Mike Tinkham's experiment and Matveyev's theory, although I think there's a cheat here also. A related subject has snuck in because Mike also talked about interesting experiments on gold, and as far as I know, gold is not a superconductor. I don't know, Mike may correct me on that. But okay, so let me talk about those subjects the moment. So, of course, we're all very excited about the observations of a metal insulator transition in silicon MOSFETs, first observed a few years ago, but now I'm, I think, getting more and more firm ground. The transition appears to occur when you're dealing with very high mobility samples that can be taken to very low densities, and so the transition occurs under conditions where you have a very large RS. Low density means a large RS parameter, very strong electron-electron interactions, and we all believe that that's essential for understanding what's going on. And this data illustrates this. I believe that this is a sample. I didn't quite catch this, whether this was measurements in Dutch measurements or they samples that were made.
I think those were Hershey samples, but I handed over our sample
Okay, so I'm not sure who's
credit for that yet.
Okay, I'm not sure whose sample this was, since he's not, I don't know, I couldn't find out. Anyway, they're beautiful. This is recent data, very beautiful, where you see over I guess a 15% change in density. This behavior of this is resistance as a function of temperature shooting up and now shooting down by pretty much a factor of 10. From about 1.8 degrees down to 0.25 degrees, which is, I think, very dramatic. Certainly no indication of its turning down. We don't know what's going to happen at really low temperatures, as Kravchenko said, but it's certainly something exciting is happening there. The scaling plots, which you've all seen, again, emphasizing the point that on the conducting branch, that things really seem to be extrapolating down to conductivities which are at least a factor of 30 or so below the this critical separatrix conductivity and maybe even lower. The other really exciting thing, I think, certainly was the magnetic field dependence. On this curve, you see essentially a factor almost 200 increase in the resistivity. Here it's somewhat less. This is a density very close to the metal insulator transition. This is well into the conducting phase in both cases. A tremendous sensitivity to magnetic fields. And also Zhang's corroborative experiment. Of course, these have now been seen not only in MOSFETs, but also less dramatically in in p-type, is it still working?
Yeah.
In p-type gallium arsenide, here's Zhang's measurements of the phase diagram in strong magnetic field, again in a high mobility sample, and you see he said in this sample there's no so-called floating of the transition at lower field, so it appears that the insulator phase extends and comes in here and that you have a real metallic phase above about 1.1 times 10 to the 11th. The other, by the way, interesting thing about this sample, is, which I note, is that which I guess has been Hungwen has pointed out earlier for other samples, that in this region the nu equals 1 quantum Hall state actually disappears and you get a transition directly from the insulator to the nu equals 2 state. Exactly what's going on there is another interesting question. So of course there are a number of very interesting questions that are raised by this transition. First of all, perhaps most interesting is the nature of what is the conducting phase that you see at in the conducting region, and you could certainly ask the question of what happens at low temperatures to the resistivity. You can think of a lot of possibilities. One is that the resistivity remains finite, and this would be consistent with the theory of basically Finkelstein and the version of it by Castellani, DiCastro, Lee, and maybe a number of other theories in particular. If that's the case, then the question is, what is the maximum metallic resistivity that you see in this phase? And experimentally, it looks like it's that resistivity is really a very small resistivity. I don't know that that comes out of the theory in any way, but anyway, that's one of the possibilities. Another possibility is that the resistance just increases as some kind of decreases, say, as some kind of power law as the temperature goes to zero. Third possibility is that the resistance actually hits zero at some finite temperature, transition temperature, just too low for us to see. Then it's maybe some kind of superconductor. This brings to mind the theory of Phillips, which wasn't discussed here, but will be, I gather, discussed later on in this workshop next week, I think. I'll be presenting a talk. Or, of course, there's always the possibility that if you go to low enough temperatures, eventually this thing's going to turn around and go up, say, logarithmically to infinity, as it does, presumably, in the non-interacting case. Well, we really don't know, and theorists are... this is certainly a very important question. You can also ask questions about the spin susceptibility in this phase. The insulating phase, what's its nature? Is there a spin gap, perhaps, as proposed by Chakravarti? Is there perhaps power law translational correlations, or so-called Bragg-Glass, as Shudip also, I think, was proposing? And then you can ask, what's the nature of the phase transition? So, for example, the proposal of Varma and C is that a peculiarity of this phase transition is that the compressibility of the system should go to zero as the system approaches the critical density from the conducting side. This would, of course, be at zero temperature. And Zhang, again, showed some data, capacitance measurements of the compressibility. I believe this is a whole... This was a whole gas, right? But it was somehow labeled as an electron gas and, B equals zero. The density state seems to vanish. Compressibility goes to zero at this RS of 8.8. Now, the question, which would seem to be consistent with Varma's picture, I don't know. One question in my mind is whether this is a true thermodynamic compressibility. If you're close to a metal insulated transition, if there are some region, if you have some inhomogeneities maybe, or if some regions of the 2D whole gas are freezing out into some insulating state, maybe they get out of equilibrium and don't, so you don't really have a true equilibrium compressibility. This is an AC measurement. What is the frequency actually that is done there? I don't know. Well, anyway. No one knows. Anyway, these are all questions. Another proposal on the theoretical side made by Xia was that there might be an influence of nearby classical percolation transition, which has to be taken into account. This would certainly be plausible, particularly if there is if there are fluctuations of density or other parameters on a long length scale. On the other hand, I think that some of the details of the model that were being discussed are not so clear to me. I don't know whether this really applies to the actual systems or not. So, okay, so nanotubes. Again, Decker showed some really beautiful experiments. It's amazing that you can make such nice transport measurements on these tiny systems. I like it as a picture of showing the nodes and maxima of the wave function that you tunnel into at various energies. I think it's just very beautiful. I guess that's fairly well understood, but there are all kinds of things in these carbon nanotubes that are not understood, which again, I think should help make us realize how much there is to be understood in these systems. One of the things that I liked was this picture, this is what I call a Coulomb blockade diagram of bias voltage versus gate voltages, and these things which are normally diamond-shaped tells you the region where you can't get current to because of the Coulomb blockade, but you see these kinks here, and these kinks are interpreted as some kind of transition from one kind of ground state to another in the tubes, and just what these ground states are, what these transitions are, we don't know. Another thing that I think is really worth very, very vexing theoretically and very interesting was in looking again at the addition spectra, looking at the spin polarization, he finds that the fact that as a function of magnetic field, the fact that all of these curves decrease, whereas theoretically you would expect some of them to decrease and some to increase, says that indicates that all the incoming electrons, at least for the weak fields, come in with identical spin. So there's some kind of spin polarized state or something going on. And this is really not something that we understand. And it is typical, perhaps, of other measurements on mesoscopic systems where we don't understand the spin polarization. And there's something very interesting going on, what it is. Again, I should mention on the theoretical side, Leon Balance gave us a very nice talk about the theory telling us all the things that are understood and predicted. And again, the nice thing is that these carbon nanotubes are really non-trivial examples of Luttinger liquid. Naively, you might have thought this wouldn't be the case because the tubes are pretty thick. And so the electron-electron interaction is rather weak because the electrons are spread out all the way around. Indeed, for example, the backscattering and Umklapp interactions are small because of the large tube circumference, although it seems that they could also be important because they're, quote, relevant perturbations. But perhaps even more interesting is the observation that the forward scattering amplitude is not small because you have a long-range Coulomb interaction, so the large size of the orbit it's compensated by the fact that the interaction remains strong over a rather large distance. And this actually gives you quite large deviations from predicted deviations from Fermi liquid behavior in, for example, tunneling properties. And this is all very interesting. And these are, of course, such nice, beautiful wires that it's really nice to see some of these things. Lauren Pfeiffer gave a beautiful talk on this cleaved-edged overgrowth technique for making one-dimensional structures in gallium arsenide. I was particularly impressed by how, on the one hand, it is a beautiful, simple idea, but how difficult it is to execute. I guess no one else has really been able to do it because it's just very hard to grow clean conducting, to grow material cleanly on a 110 surface. Little things that that theorists don't have to worry about, but he manages to do it, and they've made all kinds of wonderful experiments possible with this technique. A few people referred to Jacobi's measurements of one-dimensional, and he referred to measurements of one-dimensional quantum wires have a cross section of the order of 200 angstroms. And a mean free path for electrons, which seems to be of the order of 10 microns. The Chang Grayson experiments, which I'll talk about later, of course, were done and only made possible because of the system. And then these quantum wire lasers that Lauren talked about are possible because of this technique. And then there was some very puzzling physics. I was particularly intrigued by this jump, the frequency jump that he sees in the frequency of the laser jumps by 14 MeV in temperatures close to 55 Kelvin. Again, what is going on there is certainly something that needs our attention. Tinkham's experiment worked well. This is not so new now. This is 1996, but it's beautiful. These beautiful curves taken by Black, Ralph, and Tinkham showing the tunneling spectroscopy of electrons tunneling into a small aluminum grain, and you see the difference between even and odd you see what presumably are individual tunneling levels, and here is the one would consider the superconducting gap in these grains, omega, labeled here omega, and you were looking at in this grain we have level spacings of the order of 1/5 of this gap, and you can see what's going on as a function of magnetic field. And of course, one can see this in a variety of grain sizes, to just to be able to see the individual electron levels in a methyl grain is really a tremendous accomplishment, let alone to see the onset of superconductivity. As Mike mentioned, now they have a new technique developed in his laboratory, which actually, I'm not sure if he emphasized this, it's much more flexible than the technique developed by Dan Ralph, because in principle you can tunnel into arbitrary materials. The grain is not an intrinsic part of the grains are just sputtered on or just spun on, and you can get all different kinds of things. So in particular what he showed us was single electron levels now seen in a gold particle. And there of course were some surprises, a surprising fine structure on this, which we don't understand, but there it is. You can see the structure, and now we can look at various materials and see what the differences are. We don't have to work just with aluminum. Matveyev presented a very nice theoretical discussion of what might be the best way of watching the transition from superconductivity, or the onset of superconductivity in a very small superconducting grain, what we might call the parity gap, which we defined as, or he defined delta sub p as the energy of the total energy of a system with an odd number of electrons minus the average of the two adjacent even ones. And of course, there's in practice, you have to subtract out the Coulomb energy, Coulomb charging energy U, which he didn't include in his model, and he would just assume that that's smooth. There may be a little bit of problem from it's not being so smooth in real systems, but if you average over a few layers, at least a few different levels, one would be able to see what was going on. And he has this beautiful theory with Larkin where they get actually analytic result. First of all, there's a universal curve of what this delta P divided by the levels, delta P over the bulk delta should be as a function of the ratio between the level spacing, little delta, and the bulk gap. And they have analytic results in the two limits of, large level spacing, this is small level spacing, this is the continuum limit. And recently, Mastaloni et al. And also Seth Berger and myself performed a numerical calculation to see how these things interpolate. This is Mastaloni's data, and they go very nicely between the two limits that Matveyev and Larkin calculated. And these can be compared directly in principle to a series of yet-to-be-done measurements on the gaps and grains, just of the type I showed you two transparencies back. So let's see how we're doing here. So this is I guess the first half of my talk, but not the first half of the, but less than half of the total number of talks I have to review. This is the part on zero magnetic field, and now I want to turn to the various talks about systems in strong magnetic fields, which I will break into a few different groups, and first talk about systems in first of all, let me mention the set of talks on quantum Hall effects in three-dimensional systems. And again, there were two types. There were these multi-layer semiconductor structures, which Beth Gwynn talked about from an experimental point of view, and that was sort of half of the things that Jim Brooks talked about, and half of the theoretical talk that John Chalker gave. Then there were measurements on the bulk crystals of organic conductors primarily. Yakovenko talked about the theory, and Jim Brooks also talked about. And then I'll also, in this group, talk about a second set of talks that were given the same day, transitions between integer, these are now two-dimensional systems, looking at the transitions between the integer quantum Hall states and all, in between integer plateaus and also integer states, the insulator, which we might think of as a localization transition. Again, these were both theoretical talks by Chalker, part of Chalker's talk, and Wang. And let me begin by showing you this beautiful slide from Beth Gwynn's talk of just a sketch of the, whoops, this isn't coming out quite so well. Okay, so you have the quantum Hall multilayer and vertical transport, and on this kind of, well, actually, I guess it's a slightly conical sample, I'm told, or a pillar. And the really nice thing there is, first of all, that when they go through the quantum Hall plateaus, they find, of course, variations also in the vertical resistance, and in particular, deep in the quantum Hall regime, they find that the vertical conductance, GZZ, is proportional to the perimeter of the sample, not the area. And she did it not by just looking at circular cross-sections, but taking weird cross-sections, different perimeter area ratios. I thought that was a very nice trick. And this agrees, more or less at least, with the theory that Chalker talked about. And this was work, this now, there are a lot of people involved, I guess Chalker and Dolman, Balint and Fisher, Grusberg, Reed and Sachdev. The conductivity of the surface, presumably the current is being carried along the surface by very nice, by what are called chiral surface states, which travel around the edge in the plane, and then they can also, the electrons can diffuse up and down, and because they're chiral, just like the edge state of a quantum Hall, of a single layer, they cannot be localized. And so they, so you get a conduction even in the presence of rather strong disorder. Yakovenko gave a very nice talk, about the integer quads or Hall effect in the organic conductors, particularly Vetchgard salts, which are primarily quasi 1D, some of them might be more quasi 2D, and these are really fascinating systems, which they're, it should be emphasized that in zero field these are they're really metals, not semiconductors, and the only reason you can see quantum Hall effect is because when you put on magnetic fields under appropriate conditions, you get a series of actual phase transitions, field-induced spin density waves, so-called, and these effectively reduce the number of carriers so that you get number of carriers can be comparable to the density of a flux quanta. And there's a very rich phase diagram, and there are lots of things happening in this system, which I think Yakovenko only touched on in his talk, but we understand a lot of these things to a large extent because of the work that he has done in this, as well as a lot of beautiful experiments. Jim Brooks touched on this in his talk. He talked about organic conductors and also inorganic molybdenum 4 oxygen 11 where you see you see basic quantum Hall effects in bulk systems, but they're of course layered. And the number of puzzles that came out of that, in particular, he pointed out the fact that in these systems you get a maximum, or at least in the certain conditions, you got a maximum in the vertical. I guess in the organics, you get a maximum in the vertical resistance. Which occurs when at the transitions between the Hall plateaus, rather than in the middle of the Hall plateaus, as one found in the in the layered semiconductor devices that you would expect from this simple theory. He also presented some data on 200-layer semiconductor device, and again, a puzzle there. There seems to be a finite Hall, finite RxX, even when you're in the middle of the Hall plateau and at very low temperatures, and that this is it's not something we understand. Transitions between the different Hall plateaus or quantum Hall effect to insulator. There were basically theoretical talks, and these the real puzzle is to understand what's going on. We have combined effects of disorder and Coulomb interactions discussed by just Chalker and Wang. There's a very nice scaling theory which predicts that width should go to zero as the width of the transition region should go to zero as the temperature goes to zero, just as you would predict for non-interacting electron states. If you introduce a parameter, an exponent, delta B goes as temperature to the kappa, and this is has been supported by many experiments. You can introduce other experiments, other exponents. There's the scaling exponent nu for the correlation length, which has been measured by one experiment. Then we can define Z thermal as the ratio of these two. You can measure a Z that describes the frequency dependence of sigma XX, which might or might not be the same as Z thermal. You can try to calculate these estimates by different methods. And there's been a lot of progress in that, as Wang pointed out. They now have new results showing how the Coulomb interaction, one of our interaction, is actually relevant in the presence of disorder, whereas in previous it was only marginal in the absence of disorder. And all of this is really very nice, but on the other hand, the fly in the whole ointment is recent experiments and analyses of reanalysis of old data by Shahar and co-workers really challenge the whole assumption that the width really does go to zero as t goes to zero. And if that's not the case, we have to go back to square one. And Shankar Dasarma presented some brief summary of some of this data. Now, let's see, how am I doing? When did I actually start?
More than 10 minutes.
Okay, all right, well. Edge states in the quantum Hall systems, another topic. And there was some, of course, work on tunneling into the edge of the of a quantum Hall system theory by Kane and Levitov, and of course the experiments by Grayson, and then these measurements of fractional charge that were talked about by Goldman and. Goldman and Glockley, which I think it's proper to think of them at least in one sense as having to do with edge states, because what one is looking at in both these cases is charge moving from one edge state to another, the edge of an antidot to a lead or something like that. So it's okay. It's tunneling of charge between edge states, and then another thing I'll talk about is there were three theoretical talks on basic fundamental composite fermion theory for describing the half-filled or partially filled Landau level. Also, I might mention a poster by Quinn and Weiss on that. So let me turn to the tunneling into the edge. And, of course, we've seen maybe several times this slide, one or another version of this transparency, showing in these dots and circles here are experiments by Grayson et al. And also the open ones by earlier experiments by Chang for the tunneling exponent, in which the current goes as the voltage to the power alpha, versus magnetic field, a filling factor, 1 over nu here, and the you see they all feel fall in a nice straight line, and this green curve is the best theoretical curve resulting from two different types of analyses. Oops. Yeah. Yeah, okay. The theory is really as a function of rho x, y. Well, it would be even worse. So I mean, because then what would happen is the theory would, there'd be, if you took the theory, okay, the experiment is a function of rho x, y, the thing would be bunched up a bit here, because you have a bunch of points at fixed rho x, y, but a range of, so the experimental curve would look something like this. It's certainly in the vicinity of nu equals a half, for example, it wouldn't make any difference. And just at the quantum Hall states, it would look even worse. Well, even that's not clear, because you see, here they'd be perpendicular and here they'd be at an angle and they're at the same point. So it certainly wouldn't help very much. And so we have this embarrassing situation here in which we have a naive theory, of course, which is very easy to write down, which if you take into account only the action associated with the spreading of the injected charge at the tunneling point, you easily recover a prediction for the exponent alpha should equal to 1 over nu, which fits pretty darn well to the data. But all the sophisticated theories which are two types, they're those based on Kiro-Luttinger liquid, discussed very nicely by Charlie Kane, and also the work based on composite fermion theory, which I have to admit some responsibility for, turning into a compressible state based on tunneling into a compressible state, which was nicely, was beautifully presented by Levitov. And I should say that I admit some responsibility for it, but the real work in that was really not done by me. It was really Levitov and Shetov who did the beautiful work. But nonetheless, it doesn't agree very well. They give values which are always larger than naive theory, due more to the effect of neutral modes, which are left out of this naive theory. And as Charlie Kane said, what happened to the neutral modes? And we don't know. As I maybe indicated in the comment, there are a number of possible explanations. The one I like the best, because it does the least damage to my ego, is that what's going on is that the density is larger at the edge than in the bulk, that you have an overshoot. And if there's not too much scattering, then you could get certainly a reduced value of the exponent alpha due to that, which could also vary smoothly, but it wouldn't be universal. So that would then say that the coincidence with the agreement with the exact, with the naive theory is just coincidence. It's possible that there's enough disorder or reconstruction of the edge so that really the edge is very different. You have to take disorder into account, but I have no idea how that would really help. It's possible that the energies are not low enough for the theory to apply, and certainly at higher energies you would get a much smoother curve that would look more like the nu, this 1 over nu, but no estimate that I can make would seem to make that very reasonable, and then things should depend on energy, and they don't. And then perhaps the whole, everything we've done is totally wrong for some other reason. Which maybe is the most likely explanation, but I don't know.
So you're implying that the experiment is definitely correct?
Well, the experiment, the experiment I think is correct. The analysis, the model, that the analysis may be wrong because the model that we're using, maybe it's not really, the model, for example, assumes tunneling into isolated points. Maybe, you know, you could think of things in where the model that's being used, that the tunnel somehow it's not applicable, that there's just really a mismatch between what's being measured and what the theoretical model is. But I think in the analysis of the data you can do in different ways. But there's certainly, even if the analysis isn't right, the theory is certainly not right. You're certainly not seeing what theory predicts. Measurements of the fractional charge. There were two very beautiful sets of experiments. Vladimir Goldman talked about measurements that are actually a couple of years old, in which he looked at what I call the equilibrium charge states of an antidot, and he got these numbers that the effective charge is 0.98 of the electron charge. I'm not quite sure what the error bars are, but they're pretty small. At nu equals 1 and 0.325 at nu equals a third, where you would expect it to be one third. He also saw correct behavior of the way these things behave at nu equals 2 and nu equals 2 fifths, showing that there are two edge states, two different edge states. These are very impressive. I think the only thing, my only problem is that I don't quite understand why the charge, why it comes out so accurately. You're certainly measuring something that's closely related, that is in effect the charge of these excitations, but I would have expected that there might have been significant corrections. He has to make, the absolute value comes from a calibration based on the bulk capacitance. And the ratio only depends is independent of the calibration, but if there are things that modify the bulk, modify geometric capacitance in these systems, which might depend on filling fraction, there certainly could be, as far as I could see, corrections. Anyway, the experiments do measure this charge, the more recent experiments that Glatley talked about are really totally different. They measure the same thing. They give the same number, E star is equal to 130. These are dynamic measurements of the shot noise of individual excitations as they tunnel between one, move between one edge and another, which are very beautiful, very delicate, very difficult experiments, and it was very nice to see them done. And they, of course, the shot noise itself, there's a whole theory for it, I guess dating to Landau and Martin and Kane and Fisher and others, and it's really nice to see these things being confirmed. I mentioned that there were three talks on the composite fermion theory of partially filled Landau level, talks by Shankar, Lee, and Haldane. These are, of course, things that I'm personally very interested in. They represent three somewhat different alternative approaches to the what is now, I guess, the conventional fermion Chern-Simons description of, for example, the filling fraction a half state, and more generally the partially filled Landau level. And I certainly won't try to go through all of these in any detail, but let me just say that I think what Shankar talked about starts from this fermion Chern-Simons theory. This is work with Murthy, they use a unitary transformation to eliminate the coupling between the high-frequency cyclotron modes or cone modes and the low-energy fermions, which then have much weaker interactions because you've basically gotten rid of the Chern-Simons field at long wavelengths. These low-energy excitations, of course, they're not really charged anymore. They have zero electric charge at filling fraction a half. They would have some fractional charge, like one-fifth at filling fraction two-fifths. They do have an electric dipole moment, even at frequency a half, and you would expect that you should be able to get some kind of a theory of the low energy dynamics, for example, entirely in terms of these low energy excitations and not have to worry about the cone modes. And indeed, that can be done.
The other thing about Shank, and I think what may have motivated him in the first place, was by starting with this formulation, then by making an approximation, at least they can obtain an important feature, which is very difficult to obtain directly from the Fermion-Chern-Simons theory, which is that the if you take the limit where the electron-electron repulsion goes to zero, say, fixing the cyclotron energy, then the bare mass should go to infinity. All energies should go to zero, and that's present within this, at least, approximate treatment. So this is a potentially important advance. Haldane and Lee both work in the lowest lambda level from the first place, so they build in this feature, and they don't. It automatically happens that their whole energy scale is set by the electron-electron interaction, which is very nice. Lee's approach also builds in particle-hole symmetry, which is something that should occur at half-filling when you restrict yourself to the lowest lambda level, and that's also something very difficult to get from the directly from the Chern-Simons approach. And all of these approaches now seem to recover at long wavelengths the most important long wavelength properties predicted by the Fermion-Chern-Simons theory, in particular, for example, the finite compressibility at filling fraction a half. Okay, I think this is the. This is the last group of things I want to talk about, and I'll go through them again. There were talks on drag in quantum Hall in quantum Hall bilayers. Talks by Eisenstein, Gramila, Sivan, and Stern. Stern was theory; the other three were experiments. There were other experiments on quantum Hall systems. Eisenstein, the second part of his talk dealt with transport and higher lambda levels. Levy talked about the magnetization measurements. Willett about surface acoustic waves. We just heard the two experimental talks, Barrett using optically pumped NMR, Pinchuk using Raman scattering, and the two very nice talks on theoretical aspects of spin states. Herb Ferdick's talk about skirmions and skirmy lattices, and Subir's talk on quantum Hall ferromagnets and antiferromagnets. Coulomb drag, well, I guess one might be, I was certainly most interested in some of the anomalies, unexplained anomalies, which were seen, for example, the sign reversals of the drag coefficient seen under rather different circumstances by Tom Gramila in electron-electron systems, and I guess Jim Eisenstein also had seen some indication of that in his data, and Sivan, Yuri Sivan in electron-hole systems. Other mysteries, which are now, I guess, several years old, or at least a year old, Eisenstein in his experiments on drag in the lowest lambda level finds that the drag remains finite for T going to zero, contrary to prior expectations, and in fact it even seems to increase, and it's sample dependent maybe isn't quite the right word, but cool down dependent, or there's something noisy about it, as it were, chaotic, and just what's going on. That's presumably a hint to what's going on, but it certainly doesn't solve the problem. At higher temperatures, he finds that the drag increases very sharply when the two layers have different densities, and this is not what you would expect from any theory I know about, and that's, again, very puzzling. Of course, there's a lot of things that are understood, theoretically, and Adi Stern told us in particular about the work that he's done with Ushishkin, and I guess Kim and Millis did similar things in Saki, which is a theory based on composite fermions, which in fact does explain very important features of Jim's data, including the salient fact that the magnitude of the drag is very much larger, of the order of 1,000 times larger than in B equals zero, and they get roughly the right magnitude for this, and also the fact that you get a temperature to the 4/3 variation in at least in some intermediate temperature range, if you don't go down so low that you start seeing the constant. That comes out of the theory. Adi mentioned at least some possible explanation for a finite drag at t equals zero. The explanation that he was advocating has to do with basically assuming that you get local regions of pairing between the layers, which then contribute very large drag even at zero temperature, the increasing drag as you lower the temperature, in fact, comparable, analogous at least to he said, to Aslamazov-Larkin fluctuations in the conductivity near superconducting transition, although this is, of course, a different kind of pairing. So whether this is the right explanation, I don't know, but at least a very intriguing thing to look at. Jim, in the second part of his talk, spoke about huge, in fact, of 100 anisotropy in the resistivity that occurs near the centers of higher Lando levels, like roughly near nu equals 9 halves, 11 halves, 13 halves, 15 halves, and a few more. It disappears at still higher Lando levels. It's a really a huge peak in, say, rho XX, but no peak at all in rho YY. Why this difference? It's not present at all at nu equals 5 halves, nu equals 7 halves. And again, what's going on there is certainly an important challenge. Laurent Levy's magnetization measurements on quantum Hall systems are very interesting. They give, from the Maxwell relations, the magnetization jumps tell you something about the thermodynamic energy gap, which is a jump in chemical potential at quantum Hall states, which you can compare with other measurements. And he was able to see jumps at fractions like 2/3, 1/3, 2/3, and 2/5, as well as an integer quantum Hall effect. And there were a number of peculiarities, particularly at odd integers, which, again, not understood. Willett, again, he talked about two-dimensional electron gas with periodic modulation, near filling fraction 1/2. Number of interesting experimental results, perhaps most interesting were the appearance of a peak in the velocity shift of the sound waves as opposed to a dip, which you see without the modulation, a near filling fraction 1/2. The peak is independent of the sound wavelength and the gate wavelength and under appropriate in the appropriate range. Also, there have been measurements now. A German group showed that if there's an anomaly in DC transport in systems with parallel etched lines. Again, both of these anomalies are only seen in one of the two propagation directions and not in the other. And as Bob pointed out, the many of the features of this data can be explained by a theory based on semi-classical transport theory of based on composite fermions using a Boltzmann equation, which were worked out by Adi Van Oppen and myself, and also by Merlin. And you get, in particular, a peak in the you get the anisotropy correctly. You get the existence of a peak at filling fraction 1/2, but other features of the data have not been reproduced, and so there's still more puzzles there. This morning we had four very lovely talks. Let me just remind you of two. I stole two slides to show you from the first half. One is this very nice dispersion relation this new spin wave mode. This is in the skirmion crystal, where you have these extra degree of freedom, so you have this extra spin wave mode as well as a phonon mode, the Larmor frequency from Herb Verdick's talk. This is a measurement, this is
from the NMR measurements in Sean Barrett's talk, and again, here I just picked out the slide that shows this rather puzzling, yet to be explained, dependence of the spin polarization near filling fraction a third. It varies in a way that's reminiscent of the behavior near nu equals 1, but the polarization, what seems to be happening is only one-tenth of a spin per electron rather than one spin per added electron, or one or three, as happens with skirmions. And this is certainly yet to be understood. Maybe it's a finite temperature effect, but it's certainly a challenge. I don't have any transparencies from Subir's talk or Aaron's talk, but we just heard them, and I think we all agree that both the theory, the fact that there is this comparison between theory and experiment, for example, on these quantum Hall antiferromagnets is really very beautiful, and the fact that the possibility of even more comparisons between theory and experiment, I think, is indeed very exciting. So this brings me to the end of the talks, and I guess I've emphasized, I think, in my talk some of the experimental data, which is maybe the thing that I find most beautiful, and the puzzles. Maybe I should put up here a quote from this was a remark heard in the after the first session Sunday morning by one of the conference organizers, who I hope won't mind my identifying. This was after this beautiful talk on the experiments of the metal insulator transition and theoretical talks, and he said, "Well, the theory still needs some more work," and I think probably even the people who gave the talk could probably agree on that. Certainly, that's true in, for the two-dimensional metal insulator transition, and I think similar statements may be made in varying degrees about most of the other topics that were discussed in this conference. The theory still needs some more work, and that's good because, after all, this is the conference at the beginning of the of the workshop, not at the end. So it would be too bad if that wasn't the case. But I don't know how much progress we'll make, but I hope quite a bit. More experiments can certainly be used to help us along. I think we'll all agree that many puzzles remain in the field. Maybe the field is mature in some sense or other, but it certainly, the quantum Hall effect in 18 years has not run out of surprises. I don't think mesoscopic systems has, and I don't think the related related fields have either. So thank you very much.
There are no questions after this, so I just want to thank Brett again for the comprehensive.